Thank you for viewing this YouTube archive of a Conscious Consumer Network broadcast. Please feel free to share it far and wide. Check out our weekly broadcast guide for weekly updates on scheduled broadcasts. Help keep us on the air by contributing to our network support fund. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or get in touch via email. We thank you for supporting free and independent media.
A total credit for sponsoring and initiating the entire consciousness movement counterculture events of the 1960s.
Dr. Timothy Leary, the 1960s Johnny Appleseed of LSD.
On a PBS interview, Timothy Leary let his hair down and admitted that he was carrying on Satanist Aleister Crowley's work, and that the 1960s is when the plan began to come to fruition.
Well, I've been an admirer of Aleister Crowley. I think that I'm carrying on much of the work that he started over 100 years ago, and I think the 60s themselves. You know, Crowley said he was in favor of finding your own self and do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law under love. It was a very powerful statement. I'm sorry he isn't around now to appreciate the glories that he started.
As Satan guided Crowley, Crowley declared that his writings were to be, quote, circulated among the young, end quote. Crowley predicted that America would pick up, quote, a few axioms on which a working majority can agree, a few dogmas which it could rally. Do what thou wilt, of course, became do your own thing, and if it feels good, do it in the 1960s. Timothy Leary came up with a few of his own.
He looked out at that crowd and he said, turn on, tune in,
that's right,
and drop out.
Turn on, tune in, and drop out.
We're turned on, and we're tuned in, and we're very dropped out.
Turn on, tune in, and drop out.
Timothy Leary claimed that he came to the realization that he was to usher in Crowley's new age when he was using Crowley's tarot cards. Leary asked the question, who am I, and what is my destiny? Leary claims that he then cut to the Ace of Discs. Robert Anton Wilson declared, this shows a large disc bearing the Greek letters to Megatherion, the great beast. Leary interpreted this to mean that he is Crowley reborn and is supposed to complete the work Crowley began.
Our undercover agents in Los Angeles were very cool about, and yet they did more in a very laid-back way. And it's never been as public as some of the other, you know, the buses running around the country.
Huxley was one of the first.
After we were fired from Harvard that fall, every major magazine came out with there was a cover story in Saturday Evening Post.
Yeah, that spread it.
Yeah, there were three different stories in Playboy. So that was, it was the firing from Harvard plus the fact that Henry Luce was somewhere always behind the scenes doing certain things. Plus, so many people have been involved in Los Angeles.
Tim was more responsible than anybody for that.
Wasn't it the calculated goal of IFF to cause that kind of spreading?
Yeah. Well, I want to point out, though, that the picture, we all know that here and now study pictures more than they do long columns. The particular picture of this article in Time Magazine attacking our research had a scientific instrument called the experiential typewriter, with all these dials, actually filled with socks, but that's all right. Had an incredibly beautiful young woman sitting, taking the test, and had standing behind her, Alan Watts, a beautiful female Hindu guru named Gayatri.
Anyway, I think that's probably a good spot to start there. What do you think, Joe?
Absolutely. That was a good introduction to the theme that we're going to be developing tonight, which will be basically an expose and an interpretation, because some of it requires interpretation, of the dialogue that occurred at a party. Jan, can you describe the party to us and who
was there,
and also their connections into the CIA and the Macy Conference, so we can understand this cell that we're dealing with at the party?
Sure, and I should also say welcome, everyone. This is Jan Ervin and Joe Atwill, Unspun, episode number 20. And that was a clip showing Leary from 1977, an ABC special program where Leary admitted that the whole thing was a CIA program. And the on-screen video here, who we have here, of course, that's Timothy Leary. This is Al Hubbard, the Johnny Appleseed of LSD, and he's actually wearing a police uniform there. And he was OSS, CIA, worked with SRI, etc. Revealed in my article, Spies in Academic Clothing. I'm not sure who this guy is. This is Sidney Cohen here. To the far left there. And, you know, we also saw Myron Stolaroff. Now, they're all at Oscar Janiger's house. This is Myron Stolaroff right here on the left. And let's see if we can find a spot where it's showing up. There was Janiger. That's Oscar Janiger right there. And all of these guys are CIA, MKUltra. Now, this is basically a paper I've been working on that goes into it. But Myron Stolaroff, Sidney Cohen, Al Hubbard, Tim Leary, Oscar Janiger, and Humphrey Osmond.
Humphrey Osmond, the homicidal maniac. Can you tell us about old Humphrey, the party animal?
Well, Humphrey Osmond, he was close friends with
Aldous Huxley.
Aldous Huxley, Osmond. So let's pull him up. And Osmond, of course, was one of the CIA's MKUltra doctors, and he worked directly with Huxley. He was part of MKUltra Subproject 47 that went into MK Search, and he was also part of Subproject 111. And, you know, so he did a lot of work with Abram Hoffer. Aldous Huxley, Humphrey Osmond is actually the guy who created both the words psychotomimetic and psychedelic. And I exposed all of that in my paper, Entheogens, What's in a Name? And he did work with Abram Hoffer and Aldous Huxley creating the names for the drugs. Abram Hoffer, of course, also an MKUltra doctor, was at the Macy conferences, knew Al Hubbard, knew Julian Huxley, etc. So we're dealing with the same group of MKUltra people in this video. And what's interesting is in that clip we just played, and Steve Outram, he had put those clips together. Out of stuff that I had collected and sent him and stuff that he had found as well. But so in that clip, he talks about his getting fired from Harvard being something that promoted him, as well as three articles in Playboy. And then Henry Luce, who, of course, was the owner, founder of Time Life magazines,
Skull and Bones,
and I've I've done a lot to expose him over the years as well.
I wanted just to mention, Jan, that.
Well, hold on. Let me finish this, because this is my article, Spies in Academic Clothing, up on the screen, which I recommend everybody read if you haven't. But one thing I talk about here is that it is difficult to understand. What's difficult to understand is the fable regarding Leary's firing from Harvard in 1963 and the exposure by Dr. Andrew Weil. It appears that from the evidence that Weil's exposure was just an old trick using the Hegelian dialectic, problem, reaction, solution, or thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Without Leary having been fired from Harvard, he'd have never been able to create the appearance of the hippie guru he later used to promote the psychedelics to the youth for the CIA and Huxley and Osmond. Weil's so-called exposure and Leary's subsequent firing, along with Ram Dass or Dr. Richard Alpert, created the illusion, in my opinion, that Harvard et al. Were trying to suppress Leary's spiritual message. This gave Leary and the CIA the psychological advantage they'd need to use against the public. After all, Leary and the others were nearly all out of the Harvard Social Relations Department under the well-known MKUltra conspirator, Dr. Henry A. Murray, who headed the department. And so what we saw in that clip, though, was Leary admitting that his firing from Harvard, Luce, Playboy, all of that was done to promote the whole counterculture psychedelic meme. He couldn't have,
right?
You know, if they hadn't renamed him, and if they were still called psychotomimetics or hallucinogens, and if Leary hadn't been fired, and if they hadn't done that whole thing, the psychedelic revolution wouldn't have happened.
Right. Well, it was the psychedelic revolution. In other words, the key point to me is when Leary says, and Henry Luce was behind the scenes always doing something.
Right.
Because it is the publicity It is when these characters enter the media and our consciousness that is important. And Luce owning Time magazine, the whole Time complex with all those magazines and influence into television networks, was able to make sure, and I'm sure Luce was working with an entire armada of these individuals who are media controllers, to make sure that Leary became famous and so that he would be always in front of us. And so this is, when you go through the text and it's available at Gnostic Media, you'll see that, and what Jan has done is brought up Henry Luce's first step in the psychedelic revolution. This was, that's the cover of Life magazine, 1957. That's the story about Gordon Wasson, which is now known as Subproject 58. It was Subproject 58 of MKUltra. And there you can see very clearly the neuro-linguistic programming, the final line in the black box, which is inserted into the cover, being teenage allowances. As you scroll down, you'll see, you know, this is the story, which of course is complete fiction. This is the important thing. This is a fictional story. The woman there, I think that, is that Maria Sabina or another?
Yeah. And what's interesting is Maria Sabina had come out in 1981 in a book with Alvaro Estrada saying that before Wasson, nobody had ever used the mushrooms to find God. They were strictly used for healing for the sicknesses her people suffered from.
Right. So Wasson goes,
well, but she was a curandera, which means a cure. And so what they did was they turned her into a sabia and then marketed her as this religious saint figure. And they actually went through 12 or 13 different shamans before they selected her.
Wasn't the one that was in the village actually just a fat beer drinking guy, and they realized he wouldn't be good?
Well, he was Aurelio is who you're talking about. Yeah. And Aurelio was a one-eyed butcher. And so Aurelio, the one-eyed butcher from Huautla de Jimenez, sounded more like Jack the Ripper than Maria Sabina. Maria being similar, or is actually Spanish for Mary, so it sounds like a religious figure.
Sure.
And then Sabina, Maria Sabina, the Sabia. Yeah. So that was much more easily marketable than Aurelio, the one-eyed butcher from Huautla de Jimenez.
Right, and then if you go through it carefully, you can see, you know, how the story was assembled and why. The people, you know, were very carefully, very skillfully crafting a mythology. You know, they were making up events and giving fictional aspects to realistic people, real characters from reality, with the idea of creating an illusion, something that would fool people, something that would lure them in. The whole story in Life magazine should be studied by every citizen who's interested in democracy, because you can really see how sophisticated the government is, how clearly they're able to use weaponized anthropology against us. The cover, the story, every single thing inside it is fake. It's all a weapon. And this is 1957. So when you get to Leary, 8 years later, you're in the process of a long project to be able to start moving culture toward Woodstock, toward a debasement. And the text that we're going to be going through tonight will show that this group is relaxed. They're basically having a celebration party because they've been able to succeed in moving culture into a debased condition. And so they're celebrating it. That's why they got together. They don't believe that certain facts will ever be known by the public. So they can basically talk out in the open about some about the cover stories in some of these things, not thinking that anyone would ever be able to go back and look at, for example, when Leary starts talking about Gordon Wasson being one of the origins, you know, of the whole program. Because Leary, as in the clip you showed to begin the show, certainly knows the CIA is in back of all of this. Leary is the CIA. So when he talks about Wasson in this glowing light, he is assuming that the people who would see the tape later on, because they knew they were being filmed, that they wouldn't know about sub-project 58. You see, that's really the most critical piece to understanding the dialogue that goes on, to be able to really see kind of what they're avoiding and sometimes, you know, their secret meanings. Another critical point is when they start talking about $1 million check, and this would have been in the 50s. I mean, that would have been the equivalent of, like, say, a $30 million check today. This was an enormous amount of money, and it was given to Al Hubbard, who, you know, basically comes across as brain dead. You wonder why would anyone give that individual so much money?
Why don't we play another clip or two here, where they're talking about it? Because Leary talks about Wasson's promotion of the psychedelic mushrooms as a Joe Namath commercial. Right. And so let me just share the screen here, and hopefully I've got it cued to the right spot. So anyway, this is where Leary, he says, and Gordon Wasson, don't ever underestimate the effect of that wonderful, respectable, far-out mind he has. In Life magazine, there he is, a banker, a Morgan Guaranteed Trust banker lying on a mud hut, a Mexican, saying wonderful, wonderful.
Bear in mind that, before we go on the next, bear in mind when Leary says that about Life magazine, he's already made the comment, Henry Lewson's behind the scenes doing this, doing that, right? So here he talks about Wasson's article in Life magazine. He's actually referring to Henry Luce's activity, right? He's behind the scenes making sure that these articles get put into the magazine in the right way.
All right, so let me just cue this this up. Hopefully this is in the right spot here. Turn on the sound. All right.
Incredible Zionist politician for drugs. And the,
here he's talking about Ginsburg. Let's go back to that.
Psychedelics, come on, would you say?
Well, noticeably, we have to mention the name of Ken Kesey, and of course, Allen Ginsberg was an indefatigable Zionist politician for drugs, and they, so.
Stop the tape for a second. I have a question.
Sure.
Why is he referring to Ginsberg as a Zionist politician and in a positive light? What right. is his meaning here?
Well, that's a very good question, Joe. You want to go into that for a moment there?
I think it might just be something that slips out. I mean, when you look at the show that we did on the American Jewish Committee and the relationship between it and the Macy Conference, which is MKUltra, and now you have this party.
Well, and don't forget that Oscar Janiger, who is at the party, was Allen Ginsberg's uncle.
Right. But what you have is this odd focus on what is beneficial basically to the American Jewish Committee, what would have been seen as good. And so that's why when Ginsburg is singled out in a positive way as being a Zionist politician, and actually I'm not familiar with Ginsburg being well known as being a Zionist, so Leary may really be revealing secret things here.
Well, when you read at the end of my article, it's the fourth article in the series, Entheogens, What's in a Name? Let me just read this quote from him. Ginsburg is talking about, and it's a quote from Jay Stevens' book, Storming Heaven. He says, from there, Jack Kerouac's, Gary Snyder's, and Allen Ginsberg's days with Burroughs, they knew that one of the quickest ways to disrupt the rational mind was with drugs. But not all drugs. Marijuana worked fairly well, but an even better disruptor was peyote and its synthetic cousin, mescaline. LSD didn't enter the beat scene until the end of the 50s. But when it did, it quickly became the tool of choice for achieving that ancient heavenly connection. Ginsberg took some peyote in the fall of 1955. Looking out his window, Ginsberg had a vision of Moloch, the biblical idol whose worship he was distinguishing by the burning of children. Moloch was America, Ginsberg flashed, and he began writing a poem about his intuition.
Right. Well, they often see their political vision very conveniently, you know, as they look forward. Anyway, so it's a very, very odd thing. And I'm not sure how many people have wondered why Leary used that expression in such a positive light. But I think that a possible solution to this would be found in the show you and I did, where we exposed this relationship that hadn't really been brought out before between the American Jewish Committee and the Macy Conference and then into MKUltra, because these same individuals who basically came from the Frankfurt School then end up, you know, in that trajectory, and then they end up in MKUltra. And so you really, again, it just sort of underlines this question as to what really is in back of all this, you know, what really lies in back of all this. And in the show we did on the American Jewish Committee's connection into the Macy Conference, you know, we pointed to the that conclusion where they talked about the need to control Gentiles to protect Jews by amalgamating all of the social sciences, psychology, computing, sociology, anthropology, and then working a program out on a mass scale. Well, gee whiz, isn't MKUltra exactly that?
You see? Yeah.
So this. Well,
you know, let me add, Joe, that I believe Myron Stahlroff was, but Sidney Cohen, Oscar Janiger, you know, several other in the room there were also Jewish that Leary's sitting there with. Excuse me.
So it just sort of begs the question as to what this relationship is. It's just another thing that has to be explored in the light of day by honest investigators.
Right.
Because there is something in back of all this that has never been exposed, is very dangerous to the public, is involved in mind control. And I mean, it certainly has involved, been in mind control for since the Life magazine cover to today. And democracy demands that the citizens know what the government is doing to be able to influence their minds, right? We have the right to know that. So that's why the stuff that Jan and I are showing, we can't always come to points of absolute exposure, or absolutely clear evidence. We often do. But the fact is we are always showing things, revealing things, which are enormously important questions that need more analysis, more sunlight. I mean, our show should be basically replacing CNN, Fox News. I mean, Jan, myself, and Biggie, we should have that platform. That media doesn't deserve it. The information that's coming to you now is what, you know, are the real questions about your life and about the future. So, you know, that's why we do this. And when you see things this clear, and we're going to now go into some of the material that Leary actually identifies cultural figures as agents
right.
of the project. Leary is going to talk about the project as something which creates mass psychosis and then has a celebratory a moment, a kind of dancing LSD guru moment, you know, where he and Al Hubbard are rhythmically exchanging hand claps over how wonderful it is that they were able to produce mass psychosis. And then you'll see that it is a secret society. At one point, they talk about an enormous sum of money. I think Stahlroff comes forward and says, you know, we can't talk about this. This shouldn't be for the public.
Yeah, with Stahlroff.
And then Sidney Cohen, MKUltra, and a homicidal maniac, if everything that we can, you know, uncover. And, Jan, I just want to say something. Look, you know, when you call like Oscar, I mean, when Odsman, you know, when we call he and Huxley homicidal maniacs, you know, and sometimes we're just using the best research available because there is actual testament. If you go to, say, Colin Ross, about this guy being involved with experiments on children.
Well, let me just read right. something here from you. Let's see. Leary. This is a conversation between Leary and Charles Slack and Storming Heaven. You know, I really am a psychopath. I know you are, replied Charles Slack, but I'm one too. Leary, you aren't in my league at all.
Right. And you know, this is humor, banter between friends, but it's also a revelation of what they really think about themselves.
Absolutely. All right, let's go to this next clip.
Yeah.
What turned you on, Tim? I don't remember.
And Gordon Watts? Don't ever underestimate the effect of that wonderful, respectable, far-out mind. Yes. In Life magazine, there is a banker, Morgan Guaranty Trust banker, lying on the mud hut of a Mexican, saying wonderful, wonderful.
Oh, Lord.
Talk about Joe Namath commercial. Sid, we ran close to 1,000 people through, and each of these people were people that had considerable influence in their own right, and they were bringing the message out.
Who turned down Cary Grant?
So, someone in this room. But I mean, Cary Grant.
Here, what they're doing is they're talking about how they were bringing it to the public. And we also heard him talk about Life magazine and Gordon Wasson. And he says, talk about Joe Namath commercials.
Right. And this is why they can have this discussion in public. And even though it's, and another why they can film it, because they're still talking cryptically. And this will be exposed when they talk about the money, that there is a kind, in other words, they're not. This is a limited hangout. They still have things they cannot, you know, talk about completely. And, you know, you'll see, like, for example, like Hubbard, who was sort of the original Johnny Appleseed, is asked why he did it. You know, why he took decades of his life, supposedly risking, prosecution, even though he says that at other points, he says that he's basically above the law, that he can, you know, get people off of his back whenever he wants to, and that he can get Leary out of jail when he wants to, you know, and they all agree with this. So some kind of
relationship. And it's really well known that he was OSS, and documents have been released that he was working with Army and SRI.
They ask him why he does it, why he did all this, he says he has no idea. I don't know. Right. Yeah. And so Leary realizes that that's kind of a breach of this line that they're always maintaining of not disclosing the real nature of the program. And so then Leary leaps in and he starts basically breaking the question as being trivial. You know, he goes, oh, well
he says, Leary is always breaking it to a joke. Sorry.
Right. He goes, what are you talking about? Are you talking about Freudian motives?
Right.
Right. Like that was so our economic motives, our political motives. In other words, he's just trying to cover up for the fact that Hubbard has no explanation that he can articulate as to why he did it. So this is Leary leaping in and just keeping that line in the sand always established, you know, so that you can't go across it and disclose too much, because they want to film this for some reason. I think it was a big deal to them. I mean, you have all the MK Ultra people there. They're all in a room.
Yeah, it's a reunion party, I think, you know.
Party. So they want to film it and they want to gloat over what they've done. But even now, 20 years after the thing was created and after all of the damage that's been done and how it's actually now winding down, basically, the whole counterculture phenomenon into something else, they still have to maintain decorum. And decorum is this, you know, MK Ultra secrecy line. It's always being maintained. You can really only understand the text when you do the research into MK Ultra and know how the agents work, know who they are. It's just knowing who in the room that you have there, their relationship into the CIA makes the whole thing preposterous, right? This is supposed to be a counterculture celebration and everyone in the room is a CIA agent. I mean, what kind of a counterculture is that? You see?
So, exactly.
Anyway,
let's go to the next clip here. Hopefully I've got it cued correctly.
You always do, yeah.
Well, that last one I didn't. It was a minute and a half too far forward.
Happened, and no one has ever really
told the story of what was going on in Los Angeles during those years. I think much more was done down here. There was a much wider
You know, we're not back far enough. Hold on a second.
Have had the, you know, the walk out on a very, and trying to integrate that and still move along and do what they had to do. And I think people like Art Chandler and so on, and Bill McLaughlin, and Ron Siegel, and others that I look around the room, have had the, you know, the walk out on a very, very long, narrow plank too, looking around. And in their way, I think brought back some very good things, you know.
I think, you know, it's an interesting thing, too. As you go around the country, I'm sure you all have this experience. You talk to middle-aged, fairly respectable people in Tucson, Arizona, and they said, this is where the acid thing really happened. Tucson. In San Francisco, this is where it really happened. The Lower East Side, you know, they said, that's where it really happened. And no one has ever really told the story of what was going on in Los Angeles during those years. I think much more was done down here. There was a much wider range. There were more doctors involved. There were more scientists involved.
We had Gerald and Aldous.
Yes, right, yeah.
Gerald Hurd and Aldous Huxley.
And of course, it was part of the coolness of the Los Angeles cell, whatever you want to call it, that they kept a, you kept a...
Well, you might not call it a cell, let's call it a cluster.
Our undercover agents in Los Angeles were very cool about, and yet they did more in a very laid-back way. And it's never been as public as some of the other, you know, the buses running around the country.
Yeah, I think Zinberg says that the visionary experience and all the things he was doing at Harvard and the others, his residents and the rest of his giving LSD to, they never had a visionary or ecstatic or mystic experience, but the whole thing was a California invention.
I think that's a great spot to stop.
I agree. So... he identifies a bus painted Dayglow as...
Well, he says the bus running around the country. Yeah.
Right, but if you just listen closely, you hear the words painted Dayglow. They trail off, but I heard it clearly that time. I thought it was in there, and I was listening for it. So if this stuff has been available on the YouTube, and someone with a good audio device will be able to hear it as well, I'm sure. So he identifies Kesey as an agent, right? And if you go forward, Jan, what you'll see is then he includes into this mix Gordon Wasson, right? Now, here's what this is.
And,
what
well, and the comment, ladies and gentlemen, the comment about Gordon Wasson that we played a minute ago is actually just after this. So if we play this for another 30 seconds, he'll go right into Wasson.
Exactly. And see, so what's really important is that because we have been able to get the documents on Wasson to break through that line, that demarcation they have between the CIA's activity and the secret societies. Because remember, it's not just the CIA. If it was just the CIA, you know, that would be easy to deal with. But it's the combine, as Kesey calls it. You know, you have the Bohemian Grove, the Freemasons, some kind of level of Freemasonry. You have Skull and Bones.
OTO, the Church of Satan, a whole bunch of others going in there.
And the American Jewish Committee, right, is another one that's in the news now because we've been able to expose that. And so you have this combination of secret societies where you don't really know what's going on in back of the veneer. But what comes out is this project to control the minds of the population. And because we got the documents on Wasson, we actually have the documents, now everything can be understood. We don't have to conjecture. We know that Leary is CIA. We know that it's malevolent, that he is a lifetime actor. And when he links, say, Ken Kesey into this this definition with Gordon Wasson, then it's completely transparent. You're dealing with multiple lifetime actors, Kesey, Leary, Wasson, Allen Ginsberg. You know, you have all of these lifetime actors being aligned into a kind of a theatrical production, which is weaponized anthropology and is aimed to take the children, the young people, into a cultural abyss.
Correct. Now, what I'm going to try to do here, hopefully, is play that clip where Leary talks about the contagious psychosis. And so
This is sick. This is absolutely sick.
All right. So hopefully this is correct here. Up.
It always is.
Okay. Hold on. I got to get the right button going here. Too many buttons, ladies and gentlemen. All right, here we go.
Now, the signal content of a picture like that was much more important than the little words that are being written by some clerk at Time Magazine in the medical department. How about McLuhan?
Now, I'm trying to think, though, that what else could happen in a person's life that a shot from a religious conversion that can fire them up with the sort of zeal that we saw in the few people that we began to use it with. In other words, perhaps not everybody went out.
The psychosis.
Yeah. but it was a contagion. It was certainly a contagion.
There we go. Contagious psychosis, Leary says.
Watch what Hubbard does. Just play for another second or so.
All right.
It was a chance.
Look at that. See?
Yep. There you go.
Congratulations, Captain. Captain Trips.
Absolutely. That was the whole giveaway right there.
Exactly. See, that's,
you know,
that's
critical. And it's all a dog and pony show. See, you know, the cover story is that Leary went rogue and then, you know, and Kesey, and then they went around and spread it. But Al Hubbard was already going around spreading it to everyone. Al Hubbard had exclusive rights with Sandoz to distribute LSD, and the CIA got it from Al Hubbard. And we also have Aldous Huxley writing The Doors of Perception, which promoted peyote, et cetera, from when did he publish that? 1953, 1955, something like that. And so that was promoting it. And then Wasson in May 1957 is publishing the Life magazine article with Henry Luce talking about teenage allowances on the front cover. So they're all promoting it to the youth. Now, Arthur Colster talks about pediomorphosis and juvenilization. And in the Entheogen's What's in a Name article, I do quote Tim Leary discussing pediomorphosis. So they're all going after the children. It's a huge lie that Leary went rogue. That was part of the whole operation. You know, there's a clip where Stolaroff, or we already played it actually, where Stolaroff asks if that was the point of IFF to get it out to the public. And Leary says, yeah, of course. And so all of these things are about getting it out to the public. You know, Leary, again, we played that clip of Leary admitting that the getting fired from Harvard promoted it. The Playboy magazine articles, all of these things were staged to promote psychedelics out to the public. So this group of people that we've been showing this clip from, these are the core guys behind it, and including Aldous Huxley and Gerald Hurd and Ken Kesey, who aren't there.
Right. And so, you know, you have what we've done is we've given the, you know, people a kind of another way of interpreting this critical film. I mean, this film, in my opinion, is absolutely essential. It should be in every, you know, civics class that's taught in America's high school, because here you can really see government malevolence.
Right.
It's absolutely clear. And you know, I believe that you have a transcript of the text on the Gnostic Media site. I hope everyone.
It's not up, actually, Joe. I haven't published it yet. I do have.
All right. Well,
I do have the entire transcript right here that I'm looking at.
All right. Well, we should try to get that up, because what we really want to do is have people for themselves. You know, I mean, Jan and I sit here. We go through this interpretation, and people can, you know, contest it. We would hope that all citizens actually read the text and also read Manufacturing the Deadhead as sort of a...
Well, Well, and not, well, read the whole series also that right, I've read
the whole series. But what you'll get is an understanding of the overall program was, you know, an intersection of the Frankfurt School and Gregory Bateson in terms of why the archaic revival, you know, why the rock stars were going to be wearing rock and roll and cowboy and Indian outfits, you know, to start bending people back in time into a more primitive culture. You can see how this whole structure began. But what I was trying to say is that, look, once you know about Gordon Wasson, about Wasson's being a lifetime actor, and then you look at the pedigree of all of these individuals. I was looking today to see if I could identify one who was absolutely in the clear in terms of the CIA, and I couldn't find a single one.
What do you mean? Who is in the clear? You're talking about the big psychedelic heroes of the '60s and all.
Well, I'm talking about the people in the video.
Oh yeah, for sure.
That are actually identified as, and you can hear them talking. So you've got this preposterous situation. You've got a situation where they're trying to celebrate a counterculture and being free, right?
And it's all manufactured by the CIA and the government and dumbing right. them down.
Exactly. And there it is. I just ask yourself, how many parties do you go to where the only individual there who's not a CIA or has been a CIA employee and operative is you? You know, this isn't some kind of natural collection of individuals.
It's not a random event. This is right. Obviously these guys are there intentionally because they're all CIA and
exactly
that's SRI, MKUltra, Tavistock, etc. Right.
And then, you know, like with Stanley Osmond, go into the
I want to play first, I want to play the whole part because one thing a lot of people will say, well, Leary couldn't have done this because he got arrested and he was sent to prison. Right. So I want to play a section here about Leary and the whole prison escape bit, which is really funny. And that goes over to Joanna Harcourt Smith, who gets him in Algeria and takes him to Switzerland, et cetera. And she's an agent running the Future Primitive podcast today. And she's even mentioned in a number of books. But the reason why this is important is because people need to understand that there is a separation or a division between organizations like the CIA and your local city, county, and state police, sheriffs, etc. So, you know, just because Leary is CIA and gets run around through the Orange County Superior Court and all of this stuff, and then spends time in minimum security prison, which was at San Luis Obispo, where, ironically, Leary himself wrote the psychiatric test for that prison. And, of course, Leary wrote the psychiatric tests and the entry exams for the CIA as well, called the Leary. So all of this is important to understand because it shows that the prison escape story, just like the prison story, just like the getting fired from Harvard stories, are just cover stories to keep people off from the real track here. So
I want to be a lifetime actor.
Part of being a lifetime actor.
Yeah.
You were what Gerald Heard would have said, you were on the cutting edge of things, and that's probably where you belong.
Tim, I don't think I ever congratulated you on writing one of the best escape books.
Says Tim, I should congratulate you on writing one of the best escape books.
It's one of the good escape books.
And that's Humphrey Osmond who's talking right there.
Stop the tape. That is an absolute homicidal maniac. This individual did experiments on children. Colin Ross, who is a psychiatrist in Canada, can help clarify his role in much of this. Go to that individual for documentation. I just wanted to interject that so people would know that this banter that we're watching is occurring between psychopaths.
All right. So let's see. So what he just said there, Tim, I think we ought to congratulate you for writing one of the best escape books. I don't know if anyone here's ever read Timothy's his escape book. It's one of the very good escape books. It was really badly, rather foolishly, I think, overpublicized and didn't get the thing going right away. But I think it's the best, one of the best escape stories I've ever read. And I'm something of an aficionado on escape stories. And it's one of the very, very good ones. So here we go again.
I think overpublicized it and didn't get the thing going the right way, but it's one of the best escape stories I've ever read. I'm something of an aficionado of escape stories. And it's one of the very, very good ones.
Not as good as Papillon.
No, but it's true.
He says, not as good as Papillon.
Papillon gives you the feeling that it was being written for a movie. And unfortunately, yours hasn't been made into a movie, but it's a very good one.
Well, I tried to sell the rights before the escape, but Hollywood wasn't ready.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, did you hear that? So what Larry just said, I'm going to play it again.
It's a very good one.
Well, I tried to sell the rights before the escape, but Hollywood wasn't ready.
I tried to sell the rights before the escape, but Hollywood wasn't ready. Is that clear, everyone?
Yep. Yeah. So it was that the whole escape thing was a, it's just a detail in the life of a lifetime actor. Monica Lewinsky, they put these things out to keep the public basically following the dramatic line that they want and not, you know, straying off into questions about why everything is so nightmarish in our world. Do you want to go to the clip about the money? Are you able to do that, Jan?
Let me see if I can find it.
I don't know if you have it, but it would be great if we could bring that up. I just wanted to let people hear Cohn talk when they talk about how the money can't, the origin of the money can't be disclosed, how they shut up.
Is that when they're talking about the $1 million
check? And then Cohn, the Steiroloff says, you know, we can't talk about that. And then Cohn comes in, he says, well, we're among friends. You know,
let's see if I can find that clip here. There's a couple of,
yeah, there's 2 points where they talk about it.
All right, let's see if this is it here.
It's cost me and other people a lot of money since then.
Listen, I'm not telling tales out because I know you've shown it to others as well as myself.
Well, I think probably it's pretty kind of problem, but I had. I finally got down to $100,000. And of course, they all went away. This all cost a lot of money because there was no bill.
This all cost a lot of money.
Right.
Okay, so obviously they're being paid. Someone is funding them to do all of this that they're talking about doing here.
Anyone except those insured for it themselves. Mm-hmm. That is only a couple of hospitals and two or three clinics. But all it cost a lot of money.
It was before inflation or after.
What?
Before inflation.
When Sid wrote his paper on the complications, you remember that. And you.
All right, so let's go to the next clip. I think I know where it's at now. Should be right about here.
Now, what have you got to offer? Well, now, how do you figure this belong business, Byron?
What?
Run back to where it belonged. How do you figure it?
From the source. Huh? The person who furnished the money got it back.
How?
The person who furnished the money got it back. Hubbard, how?
Well, we know how.
We know how.
But it's not a matter for public. I don't think it's a matter for public record.
So what Steiroloff is admitting right there is that this video is for public record.
Right. Exactly. But that, and also that the public record has to be carefully monitored. There are certain things that cannot be put in it. He's talking about the elephant in the room, which is this dividing line between the MK Ultra secrecy level and the kind of public banter that they can engage in. So
right.
There it is. And if you go a little bit further, Cohn will actually use the expression, you know, he says, well, don't be, you know, basically don't be mad at anyone for talking about this. We're among friends.
We're among friends.
Only Harry is recording it. $10 million.
Everyone's laughing. See,
Dan, somebody just made a comment about $10 million, too, while they're yucking it up.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, so they basically have these connections into the government. And, you know, and then people have asked me, like, well, who gave that check for $1 million? I would imagine it would have been Billy Hitchcock.
Could have been Billy Hitchcock. It could have been the Macy Foundation. It could have been the Gestichter Fund.
Peggy Cargill. I mean, but as an individual, it would have been one of the banking families that.
Sure. Could have been Wasson for all that, you know.
Could have been Wasson, yeah. And that would have been another. But none of those individuals had the Mellon family or Wasson been exposed as the origin of the money. Then the whole charade would have collapsed. They couldn't have camouflaged the actual combine that was going on behind the scenes between the banking families, the Freemason high level, the American Jewish Committee, the MK Ultra organization. In one of the shows we were talking about the Grateful Dead, and I said, look, if you just go backstage, right, at one of the original acid tests for the Grateful Dead, what do you find? You have the Bohemian Grove, you have MK Ultra, you have the Mellon banking family, you have the Cargills, you have Skull and Bones. I mean, you know, you've got just so many secret societies there, you know, gathered inside the band. And then, of course, who's the manager of the band? You've got the son of the founder of the Tavistock Institute. I mean, the idea that you're, with the Grateful Dead, that
who funded the Grateful Dead? It was Peggy Mellon Hitchcock who funded their first album.
Right.
And Peggy Mellon Hitchcock was Billy Mellon Hitchcock's sister, and Billy owned the Millbrook Mansion.
Right, and if you look at the Mellons, basically ownership of the OSS, the European division of it during World War II, this is only like 10 years before this, for heaven's sake. So you've got this seamless web of secret societies, banking families, government intelligence agencies, and then that's the background. That's literally what's walking around in behind the stage at the Grateful Dead. In front, you've got, you know, Pigpen and all of the, you know, the long-haired people and Keep on Trucking and all this stupid music. And, of course, LSD being given out everywhere, right? But in back of it, and I mean, I'm not talking about metaphysically in back. I mean, yeah, this is just backstage, you know. Just who's there, you know. So it's just preposterous that that this hasn't come out. And frankly, it's about time the mainstream media, you know, at least those agents in it that are still free, if there are any, they should be, you know, bringing this stuff out. This is what needs to happen now. Wasting our time on this fake dialectic with Trump and Hillary is just preposterous. This is what democracy needs to focus on is the weaponized anthropology and who's behind it.
Now, speaking of the Grateful Dead, let's go to this clip. I like to play this one every once in a while. And this is Bob Weir of the Grateful Dead discussing working with hanging out at Bohemian Grove and hanging out with General Bill McQuinn, who is the original head of the OSS.
Yeah, I love this clip, yeah.
A lot of relatively well-known guys are members of that club, but basically, it was founded 130 years ago or so by artists and writers, for artists and writers. And still, in order to get in, you have to have something to offer in that regard. A lot of the members are, you know, successful entrepreneurs or businessmen of one sort or another, but they all have an artistic bent. The stuff you hear about it in the rumor mill is, while entertaining, I've never caught any virginal sacrifices, anything kind of remotely like that. I had some interesting times up there. And, you know, there are a lot of movers and shakers in that club, and I enjoy the chance, given my mindset, my Weltschmerz, if you will. I enjoy a chance to get together with those guys and knock a couple back and talk it down. One time I spent a weekend up there. I ran into a guy named General Bill Quinn. We had a couple drinks together.
Ran into him. We were
sitting in front of that place.
Wait a second.
And we just started telling.
Movers and shakers, people with artistic bents.
Right.
General Wild Bill Quinn. Well, what was his artistic bent, Jan? Was he a finger painter?
Let's listen to Bob Weir tell us what he's famous for.
We fell in together, and we started telling, you know, war stories. He was the guy that Hermann Göring surrendered, not his sword, but his, basically it was a mace. He surrendered his, but he sought out Bill Quinn, Wild Bill Quinn, who was also the original head of the OSS, which became the CIA. He was a very, very interesting guy. And we just went back and forth. We had a crowd of people gathered around us at all times. And we'd about late afternoon, we'd wander onto the deck where the fireplace was, sit down, grab a couple of drinks, and just start going back and forth. That kind of stuff, you know, these kinds of meetings and stuff like that are only going to happen there. It's the only place where you can.
Wait a second. Hey, Weir, have you ever turned around and gone backstage? You got a whole slew of like OSS and CIA creeps right in back you.
Robert Hunter and the rest admitted.
Unbelievable.
Robert Hunter admitted he was an agent as well. They're all doing the acid tests. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, they were testing the effect of releasing out in mass to the public. Those were the acid tests.
Yeah. Yeah, and so there is plenty here for the public to work with, come to Gnostic Media or Post Flaviana, where Jan and I will comment on all questions and the comments that you guys have. The LSD reunion party is available on the internet, and I would hope everyone go to it and try to look at it from this perspective that Gordon Washington shows beyond any reasonable doubt you're dealing with lifetime actors. And so this party has this elephant in the room, and just watch how many times when they walk up to it, Leary or someone, you know, will deflect them away from going any further in the conversation, because this is dangerous. So it's a sick world, and we have a very diseased component of our government that needs sunlight.
Yeah, well, that would be a massive understatement, to say the least. And I think it's really important for people to understand that you can't approach this thinking that you already have all of the answers because you've heard the official storyline repeated over and over and over how things supposedly happened. If you, you know, as the old Thomas Pynchon quote, if you ask the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about the answers. And so if you approach this
wrong question, and you don't have to worry about them coming up with the right answers.
Right. You know, but if you're asking the right questions, and first off, not approaching this as though you already know how things happen when you haven't at minimum studied every single book on the topic and gone through and analyzed the data and look at their contradictions and things, then you probably don't know it too well. And there's a whole lot more to learn there that really sheds light, such as this video, and going through looking at the transcript of it, thinking about what they're saying, the context of it, the money, the advertising through the firing and through Playboy and Life magazine and all of this stuff, They're admitting it all right there in front of everyone. So everyone, please help support CCN, donate at CCN website. Also, click on the donate button on the Gnostic Media website, gnosticmedia.com. And also Joe's website, postflaviana.org. Joe, do you have anything else?
No, that was just a really good expose. And we'll see everybody next week. Goodbye, CCN. Goodbye, Jan.
Goodbye, everyone. Until next week, take care.
Take care.
Thank you for tuning into CCN. This unique network is dedicated to free and independent media. CCN was created with the belief that information is the common heritage of all beings, which is why our live stream high definition broadcast is easily accessible and free to view. If we want to change the world, we must first change the media. Having produced over 1,000 shows in 2015, which are all archived on YouTube, we look forward to bringing you more groundbreaking, cutting-edge information in 2016. For more information on what is on, please check out our broadcast guide for weekly updates. CCN broadcasts in multiple languages and features some key voices of our challenging times who are all in pursuit of a free, fair, just, sustainable world. CCN belongs to you, the people, and it is up to you all to keep this network on the air. Please contribute to the Network Support Fund or visit the CCN shop. We thank you all for supporting free and independent media.